Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com.
So 2 Samuel chapter 3. And before we begin, there's throughout time, there's many plays and things like that that are very well written. And one of those is William Shakespeare's play about Macbeth. The tragedy of Macbeth is in this play. It's filled with drama, witches, which are called the Three Sisters at the start. It's got loyalty, this height of Macbeth becoming the king of Scotland. Banquo, his friend, is told by this other witch that future kings will come from you. But murder, betrayal, feasts, guilt, regret, lust, fight for power, and houses versus houses. Now, it's rightly called the tragedy of Macbeth because it is that fight for power that eventually consumes Macbeth, that consumes his wife, Lady Macbeth. She has visions of blood still on her hands, although there's not there. And it really is just this epic story of what is to come. And in this tale, Macbeth utters the words, "The tomorrow to tomorrow, and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets upon hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more." Life is but like a candle, that one slight huff and it will blow out. Now, Macbeth is an epic tale written in a fictional world about fictional characters and this tale of tragedy. But tonight we don't see a tale made up of fictional characters. We see real history. Real history recorded in what we will be looking at in these 21 verses. But the tragedy, really, of Abner. Instead of the tragedy of Macbeth, we see the tragedy of Abner. This real event in history, which is filled with sex, power, politics, loyalty, betrayal, a broken heart, and an epic twist. And the tragedy of Abner, you could say, begins, you know, chapter 2. In as many chapters long, in many acts, you might say this is the third act of the tragedy of Abner. Last time we saw in last act the rivalry, which is filled with which is with Joab, and this bloody fight of the 12 versus the 12, of gladiator versus gladiator, ends with the rivalry of Joab. And we'll even see that next time we get together. But in these first 21 verses, really, you see this epic story in history that could be a whole series of a book, a whole movie. But we'll seek to look at this briefly in chapter 3. Let's begin with chapter 1, where verse 1, where we see the house of Saul and the house of David. We looked at this briefly last week, but I want to cover this again, how it flows into this chapter as well. But in chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "Now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, and David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker." That here we're told this long war. We're not told how long this war is. In 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 10, it says, "Ishbosheth was king for Israel for 2 years." And we're not sure how long this war has gone on. You could say this war has been going on since chapter 19, when Saul sent people to go and spy on David's house. And this is the long war that is happening between the two houses. But particularly this war, as we looked at last time, this civil war that's found in these chapters. But why is this important? If you remember last time when we got together, we looked at Abner and Joab made an agreement that they would stop fighting against one another. Abner called to Joab and said, "Shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that the end will be bitter? How long will it be before you tell your people to turn from the pursuit of their brothers? Here are these three questions. The sword, it's endless. Battle versus battle, you just live, and there's no end. And so too, Joab blows the trumpet. The men stopped and pursued Israel no more, and they did not fight anymore. So between this time, the battle still continues. Although there's this truce, we're not told how long this truce is, but we're told how long, well, we're told that it's a long war. We're also told that during this time, the house of David grew stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. Now, a few important pieces of information are found in that statement that help us understand this chapter. In Macbeth, Banquo is Macbeth's friend at the start. They both get these prophecies from these three witches. But after his death, Banquo's death, after Macbeth tries to kill him, Macbeth is haunted by his ghost. That even after his death, he still plays a role in Macbeth's life. And so too, Saul is still included in these chapters. Although Saul has died in chapter 31, he's still playing a key role in this. That it's not the house of Abner, it's not the house of Ishbosheth, it's the house of David versus the house of Saul. That we're in this transitory period where David is anointed king, Saul is dead, but the transition hasn't happened where David is rightfully king over all of Israel. And there is this battle about who will be king over Israel. There was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. The end of Judges begins, the first Samuel, right after this time. And this is the issue that we're having in these chapters. Who is the rightful king of Israel? And in this chapter, we see Saul come up again. Not only Saul, but everyone's relationship to Saul. Michal is Saul's daughter. Ishbosheth is Saul's son. Abner is from Saul's household, fighting for Saul. And we see not only Saul's house continue, but David's house gets stronger and stronger, and Saul's house gets weaker and weaker. Not just that one is getting stronger, but as one is getting stronger, one is getting weaker. They're contrastive. They're looking at one and the other. Two of them could be getting stronger at the same time, but as one strengthens itself, one weakens itself. And we'll come back to that in verse 6. But now we're given a snippet of David's house, David's sons, and his strength. Now we looked at this last time we were together in verses 2, verse 5. But during this time, what does it mean for the house of David to get stronger and stronger? Now there's a sense in which the whole house, Hebron, as a nation getting stronger and stronger with its army, I think is definitely what it's meaning. But in this sense also, it means that David is having sons. And sons are a sign of strength and longevity in a house, especially if you're a king. So they have this stronger and stronger. But we noted last time that as he has six children, he has six children to six wives. In a matter of 7 years, he rules in Hebron for 7 years, 6 months, we're told. But in these six children, at least three of them give him great woes in the coming chapters. Three of them break his house, divide his heart. Three of them cause him great pain and anguish. We see these cracks in this foundation. What will happen in chapter 11, but also in the following chapters. These cracks that I think begin in this time here as well. We could say more, but we'll continue. Then we turn to Abner's folly in verses 6 to 11. While there was a war in the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. Now Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth and said, am I a dog's head of Judah? Do this to this day. I have keeps showing steadfast love to the house of Saul, your father, and to his brothers, and to his friends, and have gone not given you into the hand of David. And yet you charge me with today with a fault of concerning a woman. God do so to Abner and more also, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom of the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over the over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba. And Ishbosheth could not answer Abner another word because he feared him. In his book called Poetics, Aristotle lays out what he believes what it means to have a tragedy. This type of play he defines really as this: a hero destroyed by the excess of his virtues. In Plato, he mentions virtues as a positive thing, that the hero always has good within him, whereas the sense of a tragedy, as Aristotle describes it, is that the hero of the story, often you're not quite sure if he's a hero or a villain. You're not too sure. You don't hate him. There's things about him that you don't hate, but you're not quite sure about it. But in this, Aristotle describes what he calls as the tragic hero. And most of these tragic heroes have these three main characteristics. One is they're respectable and lovable. When you first meet them, they're held in a high position of power. They're noble. You know, you could see this in Abner. But then they ultimately have this flaw, which is basically the sin within them. This sin is not necessarily external. It's an internal thing. The lust or power or seeking greed. This is this internal thing that eventually brings them down. And then the third thing that they see in this characteristic of a tragic hero is they suffer in this reversal of their own fortune. They find themselves in a situation where they do something that they cannot undo. So in Macbeth, you first meet him. He's fighting a war. He's valiantly won. He's noble by all. There's this sin within him, this sense of greed and power to become the king of Scotland. And eventually he does this irreversible thing. He murders King Duncan. And so too, in this chapter, now I'm not trying to say Aristotle is right and let's try and read Aristotle into the Bible, but I think those characteristics are helpful when we look back and look at this. When you write a play, you can decide all these things in a person, whereas this is history. But I do think we see these similarities. Abner, when we first meet him, he's in a position of power. We see him there on the day that David slew Goliath. He's at these important feasts with Saul. And right from the start, when we learn about Saul and his reign, we learn that Abner was the commander of his army. Abner was at his side. Now, we don't like him normally because he's on Saul's side. But in this story, we see this change. But he has this sin and this flaw, like everybody in the Bible besides Christ. But he loves power. He's happy somewhat to be second in command, but he's the one that makes Ishbosheth king. Here, you see him take things into his own hands, as we will look at later. But he says, if God do so to Abner and more in verse 9, and more also, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has swore to him. Here, God has promised that David would be king, and Abner then says, and puts it on himself, and says, I have the power to be able to make him king. That he made Ishbosheth king, and now he sees his role to be able to make David king. He sees his hand in trying to make David king. We see this flaw that he enjoys to be this puppet master, as we'll see in this chapter and throughout chapter 3. But I think ultimately his flaw, in some sense, is this loyalty to Saul's house. This desire, as we looked at last time, this desire to see somewhat of his grandfather's house survive. Now that Saul is here, let's put Ishbosheth on the throne that our house might be able to continue. And we see this also with Abner making his house strong. While Saul's house is growing weaker and weaker, Abner is making himself strong within Saul's house. Now, he might be doing this, that eventually he comes to a point and says, well, Ishbosheth needs to be gone, and I'm going to take the throne. We don't know this for sure, but we see this. But ultimately, it comes down to this reversal of fortune that happens to Abner, this third thing, this event that happens that is irreversible. It can't be undone. Like Macbeth taking Duncan's life, this is the turn in the story. He grabs hold of that villain with inside of him and slaughters him, and eventually it becomes his ruin. But here, you see it in this passage, in verse 7, you find a few things out about things that we didn't quite know before. Now, up to this point, we're only told that Saul has one wife. And it's through his one wife that he has his whole family come from. But here we find out that he has a concubine named Rizpah. So just as David has his weaknesses, Saul does seem not to be heightened in those weaknesses, but we are mentioned here that he did have a concubine. And we also need to note the image of household is what happens in this culture. In this culture, when someone was to die, the whole household would then be moved to the firstborn, normally the firstborn. It would be moved to the next person in line. So Ishbosheth doesn't merely just inherit Saul's throne, he inherits all of Saul's things. And in this case, his concubine, in which he needs to look after her. That if a mother or a young sibling was left, then the firstborn would take care of them. They would be under their wing, their servants. All would be underneath this. But we're told that Abner has sexual relations with Saul's concubine. And we don't know any more information. Is this a one-off instance? Has this been going on all the time that Abner has been there? Is it frequent? Has it been a secret for many years? But eventually, Ishbosheth confronts Abner. And Abner is absolutely furious about Ishbosheth coming. And he doesn't come up and defend himself particularly. He gives this emotional speech, fueled with this anger that's behind him. We're told in verse 8 that he was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth and said, "Am I a dog's head of Judah? To this day I have kept showing steadfast love to the house of Saul your father, to his brothers, to his friends, and have not given you into the hand of David. And yet you charge me today with the fault concerning a woman." But ultimately he comes up and he's insulted with these words. "How dare you confront me? Do you know who put you on that throne? It was me, Abner, the puppet master. The one who has all this power. Am I a dog's head of Judah?" Now, this is not a compliment. I pointed this out again. Dogs are cute and cuddly, and we'll let a dog lick our face. Some people will. But dogs are not cute. Think of a dog that roams, that feeds on carcasses and all these other things. It's an insult. Not only in my dog's head, but in Judah. Remember, there is this divide in the kingdom at this point where Israel is the north and then Judah is the south. And here you have, "Am I the dog's head of Judah?" And then he points out again this loyalty that he's had even to this day. Even after Saul has passed away, I have been loyal, showing steadfast love to the house of Saul. This word, steadfast love, we see it frequently referencing God and his steadfast love to his people. his nation. And here, Abner's saying, oh, well, I have steadfast love to the house of Saul. Not only to Saul, your father, but his brothers and to his friends. But here, I think, is the middle of where you see the arrogance of Abner. This internal thing which is driving a lot of his decisions, this tragic hero within. That he explains that he has not given you into the hand of David. Noticed that often that Saul and David would be commenting and saying, well, the Lord has given you into my hand. Finally, the Lord has given David into my hand. But here, Abner sees himself in the role of the Lord. That the only reason you're not dead, Isbosheth, is because I'm here. I have not allowed David to come and take you over. As your house is getting weaker, I'm getting stronger, and I'm the one protecting you. This arrogance within him. He believes he has all this power at his disposal. Then comes the deflection. The only comment that goes back to what Ishbosheth had raised. And yet today you charge me with a fault concerning a woman. How dare you come up and talk to me concerning this? Think of all that I've done. Surely I'm allowed to do this. This arrogance and this deflection. But then he issues this threat. Speaks of God do to Abner and more also, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom of the house, from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba. Again, you see this arrogance come out of what Abner thinks he can do. Well, this threat has many interesting things you can stop and ponder. First of all, Abner knew that God had promised and sworn to David that he would be king over Israel. He knew that Lord promised him to do this. We'll see this again later. Now, there's a few ways that this could have happened. Saul might have told him particularly. I think Saul and Abner were very close. I don't think you keep someone close to you that you don't trust, particularly Saul. You think about Saul and what he did to Abimelech's house. Just because he helped David. He wiped his whole household out because he couldn't trust him. And now you have Abner by his side, and I think Abner is probably the one who heard of all of Saul's secrets. But if he hadn't told him early on, he definitely found out in 1 Samuel chapter 24, verse 20. When David is there and David calls out to Saul out from the cave after coming to not kill him. And Saul turns back to David and explains that you're a better man than I. But he eventually says, now behold, I know, Saul says this, that you shall surely be king. And the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. That Saul knows this. And Abner is probably very close by. And here's this conversation. But I think the thing that is most subtle in this, that really drives at Abner's heart, is that this arrogance again of Abner, that we might not even be able to understand, that Abner knows that David will be king because God has promised to David that he will be king over Israel. But why then did Abner make Ishbosheth king? Why would he then go against God, what God has promised, to make Ishbosheth king? That's exactly what we saw. It's not that the people of Israel were particularly told in verse 8 of chapter 2 that Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him to Mahanaim. And he made him king over Gilead, and the Asherites, and Jezreel, and Ephraim, and Benjamin, and all of Israel. That here, Abner's the one doing everything. He's making him king over all these places. And here he thinks he can come out and make Ishbosheth king. But he knows that God has promised David to transition the house of Saul to the house of David. We'll see more of this arrogance soon, but ultimately the puppet master's puppet turns around and talks back. Ish-bosheth challenges Abner. But Abner's plan is built upon Ish-bosheth. This is where this threat comes from. You talk back to me, I'm going to go back, I'm going to go make David king. This is the threat that he makes. You can imagine this man, he served with Saul for 40 years, fought in all these battles, a high military commander, comes up, he gets very angry, we're told. And Ish-bosheth really does seem like a young man. Although he's 40 when he becomes king, he really does seem quite struck. Even when Abner dies, Ish-bosheth is filled with fear of his death. His courage failed, we're told. But here, Ish-bosheth is just struck with fear. And we see Abner switch in verses 12 to 16. And Abner sent messages to David on his behalf, saying, "To whom does the land belong? Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you to bring over all Israel to you." And he said, "Good, I will make a covenant with you. But one thing I require of you, that is, you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face." Then David sent messengers to Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, saying, "Give me my wife Michal, for whom I paid a bridal price of 100 foreskins of the Philistines." And Ish-bosheth sent and took her from her husband Paltiel, the son of Laish. But her husband went with her, weeping after her all the way to Bahurim. Then Abner said to him, "Go, return," and he returned. So Abner finally says, my puppet is talking back to me, I am going to find a different way. I'm going to go to the side of David. So he reaches out to David, and David says, I'm going to make a covenant with you, but on my own terms and conditions. But again, comes back to this arrogant question, arrogance of Abner. When the question comes up, who does this land belong to? He's talking about Israel and all the land that Ish-bosheth is over. The correct answer is God. If you look at the law, the reason why that after 7 years and the year of Jubilee, the land is given back to the person that it originally belonged to, the person and the tribe that it originally belonged to, because the land is not theirs to be able to give and take. The land is ultimately God's. God owns the land. And it's these people that are stewards of the land. And eventually, after 50 years, after the year of Jubilee, this land returns back to how God intended it to be. So the correct answer is God. It's the land that God promises to his people. Yet here, Abner asks the question, to whose does this land belong? You want to be king over Israel? You're going to have to come talk to me. He believes it's his land to be able to give away. He believes he can make Ish-bosheth king one day and then take it back and then give it to David the next. We must agree that he certainly does think he has a lot of power. And as David is asked to make a covenant with Abner, we might step back, as Joab might be, and think this is a foolish decision. The one who tried to kill you many times, leading the charges underneath Saul, might have been one of the people knocking on David's door as he was sent to go spy on his house. He comes to you with a peace treaty. He doesn't seem to keep his deal he made with Joab. If why does the sword devour forever? Shall we keep on fighting? It seems that eventually he turned back on that promise. But David agrees, but he makes one condition. He would like his first wife, Michal, back. You want to speak to me, you want to see me face to face, you need to bring me Michal. Now, David probably has not seen her since chapter 19. in chapter 19 when Saul sends spies to be able to look on him, to watch his house. She's the one that told him, warned him, helped him run out of the escape out of the window. He placed household gods underneath the sheets to be able to disguise. And probably most likely that they haven't seen each other since then. And we're told in chapter 25 that as David has taken two more wives, that Saul had given away his daughter to Paltiel, son of Laish. Now, this is a bizarre incident, just a bizarre request, you might say. Why would he ask for Michal back? Now, I think there's three possible explanations, and maybe it's a mixture of all three of these. We're not told particularly. First is that, as someone can always hope, maybe there's an optimist here, but maybe because of true love. Michal loved David, we're told in chapter 18. That Michal loved David, so Saul gave him. Now, Saul had other plans, but Michal did love David. And here's David just wanting his first love back. But I'm hesitant to say this is the reason or the main reason, mainly because she's hardly ever mentioned after this. She's not mentioned in the feast. She's mentioned in chapter 6, but in a negative way. Maybe true love is the answer. But another explanation might be that it's just a political move. Now, this could be two different things. The seeking to bridge the gap between the two houses. Here you have the house of David and the house of Saul against one another. So why not have a marriage, like many between kings and queens? Often it is the case that if you can find two people and reunite them, then that joins them together. The household of Capulet and Montague in Romeo and Juliet, right? That there's this divide and you can't be with one another, but maybe if they got together, then everything would be happy in the end. Or maybe it's a political sense from a test. It's a test for Abner. Abner has shown his loyalty for time and time again to the house of Saul. He's served Saul for 40 years. Now he's with Ishbosheth for probably another 2 years. But here, maybe it's a test to be able to say, well, you say you want to come and be on my side. You want to help me. You want to make a covenant with me. Well, show me your loyalty. Show me if you would bring Michal back to me. Obviously, this would upset the house of Saul, but a public display. Now, that's a possibility. But I think, as always, I think that there's a theological reason here. There's another crack in the foundation of David. David takes another wife. Maybe some might argue that it's his first wife and he's taking back what is his. However, this chapter 25 seems to express that he married again when he married the two wives, Abigail and Ahinoam. He married them because Michal was married off to another woman, to another man. But David had six wives already. And then, even in his first request, he doesn't say, "Can bring me my wife." He says, "Bring me Michal, Saul's daughter." Now, he does refer to Michal as his wife when he sends messengers to Ishbosheth. But ultimately, it's theological because, again, we see these cracks in David. This warning in chapter 1 Samuel chapter 8, when Samuel gives the warning to the people of Israel of what a king will actually do, it's quite simply summarized in one word, that a king will take. A king will take your daughters and your sons. He'll take your camels. He'll take your money. He'll take your fields. A king will take. And this is exactly what David does in this chapter. And even last time when we looked at the six wives, one of the specific warnings of what a king should not do in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 17, is that you should not take for yourself many wives. Now, I mentioned last time that you might be able to get a lawyer that would argue, well, define many. Well, in the Bible, seven is often the number of completeness, full. You know, so you might be able to argue that six is not many, but seven is full. So here, he's now got seven wives. But I think lastly in this particular passage, that it specifically makes point that he's taking something from someone else. In verse 15, Ishbosheth took Michal from her husband. And then what happens? Her husband follows her. I think Nathan's parable, after he comes after David went into Bathsheba, could be used here, of the man who has many sheep, and there's this other man who only has one lamb. And the one who has the many sheep looks and says, I want that lamb. So he goes and takes that one lamb off the man who has one lamb, but he has many sheep. Now, I'm not seeking to get into ethical questions, an interesting pastoral question that a session would have to deal with if this came up is, would they need to get remarried again? They were married originally. Saul then gave her away. Would they then need to be remarried, or are they already married? And what a mess that would be. But let's not go there. Let's now turn to verses 17 to 19, where we're looking at Abner's negotiation. And Abner conferred with the elders of Israel, saying, for some time past you have been seeking David as king over you. Now then bring it about. For the Lord has promised David, saying, by the hand of my servant David I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines, from the hand of all their enemies. Abner also spoke to Benjamin. And then Abner went to tell David at Hebron all that Israel and the whole house of Benjamin thought good to do. You just have this image of Abner, right? This person who could go in and win the room over, no matter what the room is, a sweet talker. Maybe, you know a person like this, and you know a little bit of their heart or their background, and you know they're sly and they're cunning, and they'll be able to get their ways. But here, that's what you learn again about Abner. Now, you look at this passage, but before we look at it in detail, I just want to point out again the peculiar providence of this passage. This here is really a pivotal moment in that house transition from the house of Saul to the house of David. This moment here is really where you see Israel begin to start think, and Abner is the one that makes it happen. You take a step back and think about how David killed Goliath, that before this he was anointed king over Israel. But here, this key moment in this transition happens by the hand of Abner, someone who has served on Saul's side for over 40 years, the one who set up Ishbosheth as king, who started this civil war to happen between the house of Saul and the house of David, Israel versus Judah. And here, it's Abner that is beginning to set these in place. But he mentions, for some time past, you have been seeking David as king over you. Now, Abner is the one who's been against it. Abner, who's been the one leading Saul's house, who made Ishbosheth king, is probably there talking to the elders saying, no, Ishbosheth should be king. But here we find out that Israel wanted David king at some point, for some time. We're not sure how long that is. Is it the 2 years that Ishbosheth, as he's been weaker and weaker and the house of David's getting stronger and stronger? Or is it even before that, when Saul was still king and they wanted him king? But he says, now bring it about. Important sway to be able to command a change like this. The elders of Israel have been asking, seeking for some time for David to be king. And I'm sure they've heard many an argument from Abner about why he shouldn't be. Why you hate the house of David. And then the questions they probably ask, why the change of heart? But again, he raises the point. What the Lord has promised David. Now in all of this, I really doubt, it's hard to know, but whether Abner had this change of heart or not. What changed him to change sides, we're not told particularly. Again, David mourns for the life of Abner and his loss. But ultimately, I don't necessarily think it was this change of heart where he really started believing in the promises of God that David would be made king. He seems to have that arrogance that he's just doing that. Whether it's jealousy or hate or arrogance, I don't think it's necessarily faith. But Dale Ralph Davis notes interestingly that Abner is quick to quote Scripture when it supports a pro-Abner move. You hear, see here, he comes to the leaders of Israel, and what does he do? He brings up the Lord. That the Lord had promised to David that he would be king. And this just supports his move, but this seems to be one of the only times that he'll mention this. He explains, by the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines, from the hand of their enemies. And then he also goes and talks to Benjamin, not just Israel, but Benjamin. The tribe of Benjamin is small but powerful, really connected. There was a man from the tribe of Benjamin, Kish, who has a son named Saul, 1 Samuel chapter 9. And here, Benjamin is this rogue runner, type tribe. We see this in Judges, and I think it flows all the way. Benjamin, although small, is very important tribe. He goes and tells David at Hebron what the whole house of Israel and Benjamin thought good to do. So again, he negotiated his terms. Now you might call him a bearer of good news. I don't know whether I'd go as far as to say he's an evangelist, but he comes and bears good news. But we come now to the last two verses of Abner's last meal. When Abner came with 20 men to David at Hebron, David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. And Abner said to David, I will arise and go and will gather all Israel to my lord the king, and that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires. So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. Now up to this point, David has not met Abner. Probably since he met Ishbosheth king. Joab and Abner have had a confrontation, but David probably has not met Abner in person. So Abner comes with about 20 people. Now, I heard a preacher interestingly connect this incident to Psalm 23, verse 5. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. And here, David is preparing a table right before the presence of what used to be his enemy. But this meeting of these two unlikely people, and they eventually come to an agreement. Abner says that you may reign over all your heart desires. But the difference between Abner and the difference between David is a great difference. Ultimately, what comes in his heart? We don't know Abner's driving forces behind a lot of these things. What drives him to be able to make Ishbosheth king? What drives him to be able to turn his back on Ishbosheth and go side with David? We don't know any of these types of things that drive his heart. But we are told that as Saul was rejected, God speaks to Saul and explains that your kingdom shall not continue in verse 14 of chapter 13. And the Lord has sought out a man after his own heart. And the Lord has commanded him to be a prince over his people because you have not kept the law, what the Lord commanded you. Here, the desires of your heart are found in David. And he says, do what all your heart desires. And David is sitting there going, I want to do the will of God. I want to be king when God anoints me. But David ultimately sends Abner away in peace, shalom. Some people again have tried to connect this to David as a shadow of Christ, sending away his former enemies away in peace with him. I think this preaches well. I think that might be jumping, I think there's definitely connections there. But in broader passages like this, I think we see Abner and we see Joab, and they're seeking to really drive the outcome of the situation, to be able to make it so that they're the winners, they're the ones that are the heroes, to influence the outcome of the kingdom. Abner, who we probably would all boo if he was to walk on the stage, eventually, I think, changes our hearts a little to be able to maybe not hate him as much, to be able to know more about him. But that's the story of the tragic hero, the twist, a turn of not knowing for sure if Abner's really a hero or a villain. However, we see, held up on this question, if you have to be a hero to do God's will, then we're always going to hit hurdles, right? We've seen the weaknesses and the fractures in the foundation of David. Well, if we see those fractures and weaknesses, how then can God use him? But God uses all people, heroes and villains. He's a king's heart is like a stream of water in the hands of God. And even a commander of the army's heart is like a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. But the tragedy does not end there. We might only be in Acts 3 out of 4 of the tragedy of Abner. But as we read earlier about life, and it's but just like a candle, by the way of dust to dusty death, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. And that's what we'll look at next time in 2 Samuel verse 22. Just as the servants of David arrived with Joab from a raid, bringing much spoil with them, but Abner was not with David at Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. And then we see just these two paths cross again, this rivalry between Abner and Joab, and that'll strike up next time.
Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com. Seven Springs Presbyterian Church began in 1874 and is a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America located in Glade Spring, Virginia. Please join us for worship on Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for His glory and His gospel.